This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
Speaking of stealing things, Black Flag Playtest Packet 2.
I don't want happiness in my gaming. What's the matter with you people?
Failure is part of the game, not a bug.
If I have infinite kryptonite.
It was basically things that have been removed from 5th edition that people want to be put back.
Please, for the love of God, J.Crawl, tweet out when you release one of these videos, please.
Are you guys honestly having fun?
If you design a game by committee, you're probably not going to get a very good game.
I'm on team Smite Shouldn't Crit.
Brugger.
Bruges.
Bruges.
In Bruges?
In Bruges. Yeah. All that and more right now.
3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to... Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one podcast in all the world. Every nation, every accent loves this podcast because we talk all about tabletop RPGs and D&D. My name is Ben Byrne, and I am joined, as always, by Sean Merwin, James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, and Dale. I don't know if I've asked this question before, but I'm going to throw it out there again. Maybe the answer's changed. What is your gaming snack of choice when you're playing a board game or a tabletop role-playing game?
Ooh, I'm one of those people. I can't and don't really snack while gaming, particularly while DMing.
Yeah.
I can't. I've got too many things that I'm doing. I feel like I'm having to talk all the time. If I dare to put a grape in my mouth, that's the minute I'm going to have to speak. So I don't tend to snack while I'm gaming. Board games, I don't know. I don't like getting cards or things greasy. I will snack before and after the game. That's me.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I agree with like the spirit of a lot of what you're saying. I'm not sure if no snacking is my answer.
It's necessarily not like a forbidden thing.
Thou shalt not snack.
Yeah. This pandemic has really devastated my ability to snack during games, because when I play in person, that's when I like to snack. Otherwise, I'm kind of sort of muting my mic all the time, being like, oh, hold on. Oh, did you hear that? Click. I love making homemade guacamole and serving tortilla chips with that. I love guacamole. I love to make it. But again, it's the problem that Dale brought up of getting grease all over your step, because those tortilla chips, you know, they're not as bad as potato chips, but they're still pretty nasty when it comes to leaving stains on cards and character sheets and stuff like that. So eat a meal in the middle of the game and then go back to play.
Is beer a snack?
You know, this question was originally going to be, what is your drink of choice? Like, mm-hmm. What's your poison when gaming? But I didn't necessarily know if we all drank while gaming. But beer is definitely a snack, sure.
Some of us have to put up with our players. We try to eat before, but I've gotten around this by using candy as miniatures so that you could eat after, you know, you defeat the monster. Oh, it was a large monster. Here's a big Reese's peanut butter cup, or here's a small dark chocolate
one of those
Hershey's Kiss.
Huge gecko gummies.
Exactly, right? But as the game master, I may have to try a couple just to make sure they're okay. I wouldn't want to give the players bad snacks.
You don't want to accidentally poison anyone, exactly.
Right, not accidentally, no.
There's actually, I don't know, maybe the three of you will know it more than I, but I have been repeatedly kind of told about this role-playing game, or I think it's actually a war game, like a tabletop war game called Tiny Teddies Go to War. And it's basically a tabletop war game where everything, the terrain, the war pieces are all just snacks and lollies. And whoever gets to eat their opponent's entire side first is the winner, is my basic understanding of this.
I think in America, Tiny Teddies are called something else.
We found it already.
Teddies, something like
Teddy
that.
Teddy Grahams.
That's the one.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Why are they called
that?
Because they've got
graham crackers, which is weird to say because you say graham crackers, but we say graham.
Yeah, are we saying graham is in the unit of measurement or graham is in the name?
Like the name, yeah.
Do you have animal crackers over there?
No, not really. We have the McDonald's crackers.
What's the McDonald's crackers?
You don't remember the little
the animal-shaped cookies. Yeah, gotcha. Or they were shaped like the McDonald's mascots.
Yeah, Yeah. Back when they still acknowledged Birdie and Grimace
when
and
they
the
were
gang.
Part of the canon before a new producer came in and like rebooted the McDonald's cinematic universe.
Strip this all back to basics.
Got to do a reboot, the new 52 of the McDonald's canon.
First things first, no one's stealing our burgers.
Yeah, it was just encouraging people. We found it to be like really poor business model. Anyway, talking about tabletop role-playing games, let's dive into the news. And speaking of stealing things, the Black Flag Playtest Packet 2 is now out. I kid. That wasn't even first
pirate
on the run sheet.
Pirate-themed.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Yes, Playtest Packet for Black Flag 2 is out. Have we had a chance to read through it?
I read through it this morning. Well, actually, I read through half of it last night, fell asleep while reading it, woke up this morning, finished reading it.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some good stuff in there. It's got some stuff that feels very much like, okay. Mm-hmm. Every now and then I would be like, are you even allowed to do this? You've got Magic Missile. And then I would remember that we live in a different world now. So have at it.
Right,
Take your Magic Missile, confirm that each dart is going to individually do 1d4 plus 1 damage. Love that for us.
So look, if we break this down, there seems to be, and I didn't get to read it super, super thoroughly, so I'm hoping that the three of you can kind of fill in detail here, but it
this
seems to be broken
just start
down
making stuff up.
Into three broad kind of locations, right, which is the luck, which is the luck mechanic, the new versions of the fighter and the wizard class, which go to level 7 or level 8. And then kind of because you've got the wizard there, they need to address how their new magic system sort of works and how they're changing that.
New magic system.
Yeah. A lot of circular shapes in this magic system. What do we think of, let's talk about the luck mechanic first. It's the first thing that kind of pops up. It's quick, it's simple. Do we like it? Do we dislike it? Do we have a more nuanced opinion than that?
Well, let's start with this. The luck mechanic says right in the playtest that it's there to replace the inspiration mechanic. Mm-hmm. And the inspiration mechanic was sort of a flop because it tried to do something that narrative games do without being a narrative game. I've said this, and I think people took it wrong, that D&D is a microtransactional game, and I don't mean it in terms of paying money for content. I mean it in terms of you do a lot of small things in order to do a bigger thing.
It's ultimately a resource management game.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And so these mechanics, as they're used in narrative games, are there to handle large narrative things. It uses the playtest uses the term fail forward. And in terms of the vernacular where we might use it in our everyday lives, fail forward might mean you failed, but you learned something, so next time you will be better at it. In a role-playing game, though, that's not what fail forward means. In a role-playing game, what it means is you're not doing a small mechanical transaction. You're looking at the larger goal. And you may achieve that larger goal, but there will be consequences or conflicts or something that happens that makes it messier than just succeeding. And I think what this luck mechanic tries to do is the same thing that the inspiration tries to do, which is put into a microtransactional game something that really doesn't need to be there. So
yeah,
it may work beautifully, but it's still trying to do something that I don't think a game like D&D, like Black Flag, needs at all.
I agree with you in some ways. I disagree in other ways. On the big picture, I don't much like it. I think it's a cool idea. Mm-hmm. I think it's identified a problem to solve, which is that it feels like crap to spend your turn doing nothing because you rolled poorly.
You know what you shouldn't play if you don't like that?
D&D, maybe. Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly the thing, is that if you're gonna have a resource to spend to, you know, dodge out of failure, eventually that resource is going to run out, and suddenly you've still got the problem again. And so you've just sort of ameliorated the issue for a brief moment. And I think there's some potential for good game feel moments where you do spend luck points and you succeed, but it just, it feeds into this ever-present problem of the 5-minute adventuring day in D&D, where once you're out of the resource, well, there's no sense in continuing anymore. So let's just call it for today. I don't know. I feel like a different solution to this problem would serve it better, or simply accept that that this problem, as we call it, is a feature of the game and play games that don't have it if you don't want it.
I do want to hear Ben's folded arms statement, but just very quickly first, I feel like a little bit of devil's advocate here. I will say that while it does make sense to be like, if that's not something you enjoy, then D&D probably isn't for you, because it is kind of a feature of how this game is constructed and works. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem is that they have built, at least for 5th edition, a system wherein magic users, broadly speaking, don't have to worry about that feeling. Spells just work, you know, and you've got your whole separate, on top of everything else, meta currency that you're dealing with when you're casting spells. Whereas if you want to play a martial class, that is something that you are forced to deal with. So maybe it would feel a bit better if the magic users had to wrangle with that kind of a thing as well. But they can completely and easily build themselves a spell list where they never have to worry about rolling dice and missing the bad guy. They just get to pick where on the map is going to blow up. And that's, you know, that is more fun for them than it is for the people who don't get to do that. And so you end up with whole parties of casters and it's all just kind of a mess. Ben, why have you folded your arms?
I mean, I think that I agree with the statement. I went on a rant about this actually just before we recorded with Dante, that like failure is not a bug in the game. It's a feature, right? I don't know where to start. I don't know where to start, Dale, in terms of this rant again, because I also agree with some of what you were saying in terms of spellcasters, it's not a problem that they have to deal with as much. That being said, what I found was interesting when we were introducing new players to the game is we would create pre-generated character sheets and they would have cantrips on it. We created a warlock who was meant to be like, you know, the weirdo, so to speak. Like they were they were Pact of Ancient One, whatever it is, the kind of Lovecraftian pact, and they were meant to just kind of be a little bit strange and in the corner and whispering to themselves. And we gave them, I think, Toll the Dead as their cantrip, and the new players found that cripplingly unsatisfying because they didn't get to roll the dice. And so it just felt like the GM was deciding when or not the cantrip succeeded or failed. So I think that casters, you know, and even if it's a cantrip where they do roll the dice, I think they still have that to some capacity. I wonder if this, it feels bad to fail, is something that's more a problem in the early levels, like the pre-level 5 parts of 5e specifically, because when you're a fighter, you attack once, and if you miss, that's basically the end of your turn. And if you're a caster, you still have that cantrip problem because you don't necessarily have endless spell slots. But then once you get past that level 5 bump, you get to attack twice in a turn. And sure, you might miss both attacks and that would suck, but at least you get to have another go if you miss the first one. And it feels a bit more like a duel where there's a parry and then there's a second blow. And that's when the spellcaster also comes online and gets to use their spell slots to do those always hits spells. But this idea that like the game must be fun 100% of the time and like failure is not an option and it's unfun to fail. It's like, yeah, that's true. But like, that's part of a narrative. Like if you don't have failure, you don't have drama. And how awesome was it? We saw this moment in Legends of Vox Machina recently that was a recreation of a moment from the actual game when they were fighting, I can't remember the name of the dragon off the top of my head, but the black dragon, the acid-spitting dragon, and Grog dives at him and smacks him with the axe and the axe head shatters in the animated series. And then you flash back to the actual play and Travis rolls the dice and he's like, oh, a 19, I think he rolled, or an 18 or something like that. He's like, I rolled a 19, and he's already got his damage dice in his hand ready to go. And Matt goes, that doesn't hit. And just the look on Travis's face, and it's like, yeah, that's right. The stakes here are like been massively raised. You can't just throw your daggers and your axes at this thing and hope to take it down. You've got to think more laterally than that. maybe 5e doesn't always support that lateral thinking, because a lot of the time the most efficient thing to do on your turn is just attack or cast a spell.
I agree with all of that. I don't think that the answer, particularly for D&D, the feel of D&D as a fantasy RPG versus other RPGs, I don't think the answer is to eradicate failure necessarily. I think other games could do that and that would be fun, but I don't think that that's like the course that needs to be taken for D&D or D&D-esque systems necessarily. But yeah, and there are other ways that things get mitigated, right? It's like the reason that the Battlemaster Fighter is so beloved, because you have these ways of mitigating your misses, right? You can yeah. choose all these maneuvers that make you more likely to hit. And then you're not worried about, you know, and you're getting choices, which is nice, where I think my major problem recurring with the fighter base class is that most of the features you get as a fighter are passive things that don't let you make choices. If I make a choice and it fails, that to me is fine. That feels fine. But if I've got very little in the way of options and I do the one thing I can do and it fails, that's when it starts to suck. Regarding sure. this actual luck mechanic, I mean, what I will say about it, I don't love it or hate it. I will say I think it's better than inspiration, as inspiration exists in 5e. And I think my major sticking point with it at the moment is that you've got a maximum of like 5 luck points that you can get. And the ruling is if you would then gain a 6th luck point, then you have to roll a d4, and that's how many luck points you have now. And I hate that. I hate it. I get it. They're trying to encourage you to spend it rather than saving it and forgetting about it, because that's, for me, a big problem with inspiration is that you forget that you have it. But 5 feels like so few. And if you've missed 5 times and you miss a 6th time, but now you have less luck points, I feel like that's just back in the bin of you're having a terrible night. It's also, I don't know, that's just me.
It's also really gameable, because on that, if I'm reading this correctly, if I'm understanding the order of events correctly in terms of the role and whatnot, you have your 5, you save your 5 until you think you might really need them. But then if you roll the dice, and let's say you know the AC is around 15, 16 from previous attacks, and you roll an 8, and you know your 5 can't reach that 15 AC, you just have to spend 1 luck point before the GM declares whether it's a success or failure,
and
you end up on 4 luck points, and then you gain your 5th back for failing the attack because you spend the luck point before the GM declares whether it's a hit or a miss.
True.
Or
and you also you can spend 3 and you re-roll. Yeah. Which is
right.
Also,
yeah, correct.
Basically the equivalent of spending 5.
Yeah.
On average. Yeah.
Now, I do want to note that they have a little disclaimer here in their behind the curtain section that says, if possible, make sure to actually give this system a try at your table before providing playtest feedback. And let's just note that none of us have actually given the system a try before we have sort of started critiquing
100%.
It. 100%. Yeah,
it's totally true. Yeah, it's totally true that you should playtest everything before you actually write out your feedback. But there's also experience that we have with systems that are similar. And when you see something, when I see something in the rules, and this is in every rule, and I've written this rule before, so shame on me. But when you say, and you have to tell the dungeon master whether you use this before they reveal whether it's a success or a failure, right there, you are slowing the game down. And then you are opening it up to my co-player on my right knows the AC of the beholder. I don't, though. So I roll and I get a 12 and I have 5 luck points and I'm thinking, okay, should I use 1? Should I use 2? Should I use 3? And the player's like, use five, because they know the AC of whatever creature it is that I'm trying to hit. And then the game master goes, no, you don't know that. And it turns into this metagame, and metagaming is not a bad word per se, unless it becomes something that slows down what you are actually trying to do in the game, which is roll a die and tell a story. And this is roll a die, consult, consider, wait, or don't wait. Oh, I don't, as the game master, I don't like luck points. So I'm going to say right away, oh, I'm sorry, that misses. And then the player says, no, wait, you have to let me. And it turns into this whole thing. Whereas what is the problem you're trying to solve? Is the problem you're trying to solve that sometimes you fail? If that is the problem, then in the classes, put something that allows you to succeed. If you're a fighter, if you miss with a certain kind of attack, or as a bonus action, you could automatically do damage. Then you are getting over that problem. You are letting them do something without trying to put in a whole other system that may be great, may be bad, may rely on your preference, but is still something that might be tacked on that doesn't need to be there.
Legitimately, I think it would be a very cool option if at fifth level, fighters gained, in addition to their multi-attack feature, as it's called in Black Flag, the ability to spend your entire action making an attack that considers you to have rolled a 25 on the roll, right?
Whoa, I thought you were just going to say the minimum required to succeed, but well, 25. I mean,
sure. Well, whatever, you know, this attack automatically hits an AC of something high, but I don't know. I'm giving wiggle room for DMs to have their big sort of creature that has high AC as its thing and out. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But let's say, you know, you automatically hit AC 25, but you have to spend both your attacks on that turn. So now you're faced with a choice. Do you gamble on two high rolls to get more damage, or do you play it safe and you take the sure thing? That to me feels like a really cool fighter thing that plays into the class fantasy, especially if there's a subclass that it's tied to, something like a knight who isn't a big gambler, who likes to have the sure thing, stoic and straightforward.
And here's the last stand feature that we see, which is basically second wind. Instead of that, or in addition to that, say, or roll a hit die and do that amount of damage to a monster that you see. There. Now you've found a way to automatically see this problem can be solved in other ways, but we're not designing this game. You know, Kobold Press is, so we need to let them do what their goals are. And we should just give them our feedback, but not our design, because that's what they should be doing. And that's what they want to do.
Cosmic Postman asks, is that the philosophy of the Barbarian's reckless attack? Sort of. The Barbarian's reckless attack is a sort of give and take, in the same way where you open yourself up to more damage after to increase your odds of being successful with your hit. Because it's less black and white, because advantage is less clear cut than saying, like, you can hit AC 25. What these rules are trying to encourage is finding a way for you to more or less guarantee a success out of a failure situation. And I think there's a lot of merit to that, legitimately, but it does have to feel like something you're choosing to do with a potential drawback.
Well, that's why Dale mentioned before, you know, fighters in 5e have that hit or miss passive ability. It just kind of sits there and you know, it gives you some sort of buff, but at the end of the day, if the dice say no, the dice say no. Whereas the martial action, which is the cousin's version of fighting styles, these really stood out to me because at first I wasn't sure if I loved them, especially because they're active, they're not passive. So aim requires a bonus action, and I'm just quickly reading it again now so I get it right.
Yeah, kind of instead of a fighting style that says, you know, you get +2 to these types of attacks, that is just flat and always there. These are similar things, but they are activatable abilities that are always a choice you have.
But they're less frequently applicable, right? Because you need to use that bonus action. And then I think it says, and again, I'm trying to skim it as we're sitting here, the first attack that you make has advantage or some sort of bonus, which once you have that multi-attack, it's kind of like, well, I'm not getting this bonus as often as I would if with the archery fighting style, which is just like a +2 on every ranged attack.
I also like having, because the fighter doesn't have that many uses for their bonus action, and I like having stuff to do with my bonus action on my turn. I understand that we want to speed up combat and whatever, but I don't feel like it slows me personally down to be like, and I will do this with my bonus action. I like having another thing I can do on my turn. It feels good. But that's, again, just me speaking for me. So
the reason given by 5e developers early on for turning 4th edition's minor action into 5th edition's somewhat odd bonus action, which you, you know, either have or you don't, because a class feature gives you a bonus action, not the other way around. Not a bonus action lets you do a class feature. Class features give you bonus actions, is how 5e is supposed to work. No one treats it that way, though, because it's much simpler to think about it in the way the 4e did it, which is you have a move, an action, and a minor action. It's just that at the end of 4th edition turns, what the designers say was a problem that bogged down combat was, wait, I haven't spent my minor action. Can I do something?
Is there anything I can do?
Can I make an intelligence check with my minor action? And
flipping through your folder of character sheet bits that I mentioned last time.
Yes. And it seems like the switch to bonus action did not really solve that particular problem. It just kind of obscured it for a little bit.
I do just want to say, I understand why you wouldn't, because dismantling and rebuilding a magic system that makes sense from scratch would be a lot of work. And I get it. And I don't blame anyone for not doing that. I didn't do it. I'm never gonna. It's so much work. But I will say, people love this changing the name of spell levels to rings thing. I've heard it before. And I get it. I get why people like that. For me, I don't think it fixes the problem. Saying, yes, a first ring spell doesn't really solve that problem for me. And now we have, in this particular playtest, spell circles or magic circles, arcane circles, whatever they're called, spell rings, which are the same as spell levels, and we still have schools of magic. And I was surprised to see that we have both the circles, which were the weird and the, I don't have it in front of me.
Primordial thing. And arcane, I think.
Yeah. And then also still have spell schools. I was a little bit surprised about that, just because it feels like an extra thing to learn. Their description of it was cool and evocative. You know, the rings of the tree. I liked these whole descriptions. But to me, it still feels... I'm not blaming them. I think the problems are sourced from the longstanding history of D&D and magic therein. But I it's one of those things where we've changed some stuff, but I don't think any of it fixes it.
Mm-hmm.
I will say as well, the weird circle.
Yeah.
We mentioned before, and we were like, is it going to be about sort of fate or, you know, things like that? And it's not. It's sort of elementals and summoning. And I will say, I have, previous to any of this, in my own personal free time, tried to investigate why, at some point, weird did move from being about fate to being something about sort of elemental summons. Because I've seen it show up in like Magic the Gathering and stuff as like beings that you summon. And I don't know where that connection happened. Maybe someone out there knows when that leap happened. If they could tell me, that'd be great, because I haven't been able to figure it out. But it does predate Black Flag.
I always assume that weird when I see it with that Y, and this might be an answer to the link, but I don't know this. So again, somebody might know better, was just a weird no pun intended, a strange misspelling of the word weird to be like weird magic, as in
isn't
like Lovecraftian style magic. Yeah, exactly. And so with the Y, looks more tentacly, I don't know, but like was like, you know, like, weird, but like not normal weird, like weirder than weird. I don't know. That was always my take on it. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Weird is all about fate and destiny, and it goes back to the weird sisters of Macbeth, the three witches.
Hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have no idea how that definition got contorted. In fact, it might have something to do with D&D. Gary Gygax might be our culprit here, as he often is, because there is a spell in some editions of D&D called Weird that does some funky stuff.
It was a ninth level illusion spell in first edition, I think, that may have come out in the Unearthed Arcana, but I can't remember.
I think that, yeah, there's still Cosmic Postman mentioned it. Weird, W-E-I-R-D, is a current ninth level spell.
It creates really scary illusions that frightens creatures and deals psychic damage. So it's like a big phantasmal killer or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah,
it feels kind of underwhelming for all the buildup we've given it.
Just on the Kobold Press, on Black Flag, if you go to the blog page where the Black Flag playtest packet 2 is, there's a link there on their website to another blog which talks about how to give playtest feedback in a way that is cordial and polite and purposeful, rather than just complaining about what you don't like about a certain thing or how you would design it better. So I just think I thought I'd give that a shout out because we have two simultaneous and very similar looking games that are in this active playtest going on at the same time now. So maybe going and reading that article might be useful for some folks to make sure that they're not just having emotional responses to the playtest, but actually providing useful feedback. Well, speaking of build up, let us quickly change topics across to the 1D&D survey results. I think it was D&D Beyond YouTube channel, or it might have just been the D&D YouTube channel. I don't know when they're just amalgamating those or not. I
find it unreasonably difficult to find these videos. I always miss when they're released.
Yeah.
I end up watching them weeks late.
Yeah.
I have to specifically search them using like Google. I don't know.
Jeremy Crawford was talking about the previous playtest around the expert classes and some of what they found there, but also the more recent playtest, which survey is about to go live around the Paladin and the... What else was in that one? Paladin and
Druid.
Druid, thank you. That's right. He had some interesting things to say that I think are academically interesting around, pardon me, the direction that they're sort of taking with this playtest and their thought process with this playtest. Mm-hmm. Did anybody else have any thoughts around that video that they thought were interesting?
I did, but I have to wait until the D&D movies come out and everyone's seen it. Oh. I'm gonna wither away if people don't get to see this movie soon.
Two weeks.
I want to talk about it.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yes.
Gotta hold out.
I'm gonna see it.
Yeah, me too. I thought Jeremy's video was incredible. I thought it was finally the thing I have been asking for over and over again on this podcast, which is tell us what you're trying to do. And then we can ferret out some of the details and maybe even help you in our feedback. And that's exactly what he did. He is a smart, smart man. And the team that he is leading on this, they're going to knock it out of the park if they're given the resources to do so, if they're given the time to do so, and if they are allowed to pursue the goal of making it the best thing it can be. Now, I'm not saying all of those things are going to happen, but at least the way he described the things, it gave me great faith in the designers there because they were going into great detail. Jeremy was going into great detail about this is why we decided to do this change. He talked about the rogue, which I thought was incredibly important. The rogue got, this was the funniest thing, I think. People would give very high scores to the individual traits of a class, but then give a lower score to the overall class. And that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense logically, but Jeremy explained it. It was basically things that have been removed from fifth edition that people want to be put back. So for the rogue, it was people want to be able to do sneak attack on other people's turns. And so they could love everything, but they're going to give the overall rogue a lower score. And then he explained why they took out the sneak attack on other people's turns. And it makes perfect sense because it slows the game down as people try to decide what they want to do or not do with other people's turns and what they can do or can't do. And then some players forget that they're even allowed to do sneak attack, you know, all of that. And it just shows what a tough thing designing games are. Kobold Press is going through it. Wizards of the Coast is going through it. All game designers go through it at some point, which is players want something, but they also want the thing that causes the thing they don't want. Right? They want quick games, but they want lots of choices and they want things that happen all the time that slow the game down. So they are constantly churning through not just the numbers, but the actual written responses to try to ferret out what balance they can walk, what's the line they can walk to make diametrically opposed players happy both. And it was just fascinating to listen to.
Mm-hmm. I so thoroughly enjoy hearing people talk about analyzing feedback like this. It just, I don't know, it scratches something at the back of my brain. It just makes me really happy that the thing of, here's what all the numbers say. Here's our like quantitative data. What can we try and discern from that? All right, these are the bizarre questions that we end up with. Now let's look at the qualitative data, the written responses, and try to figure out a thread there that makes it make sense. Oh, it just brings joy to my heart. It's also... It's just a really smart idea to release a video like this ahead of the next survey, just because human beings, we have a tendency to panic a little bit when we feel defensive of a thing that we like. And it's just a good move to have Jake Roar come in and say, okay, we hear you. we've been paying attention to the response. Here's some extra information that might make the whole situation, the big picture, clearer for you, so that when people fill out the survey, it's maybe a little bit more reasoned rather than sort of knee-jerk reaction, which I think is just smart. But please, for the love of God, Jake Roar, tweet out when you release one of these videos, please.
Oh, you're not subscribed to the D&D or the D&D Beyond channel? It's one of those. I don't know which one.
Don't call me out.
Yeah, I really liked, you know, as Sean mentioned, his explanation around sneak attack, I thought was really interesting. I also liked that he was reasoning out kind of where the designers think that things are going to go. And you can see that they're, you know, I think, what did we describe D&D, one D&D as being like the design equivalent of moving the furniture around or throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Feng shui.
And I think that is, like, from what Jeremy was saying in this video, that is kind of what they're doing, but doing with more purpose than it might have initially seemed, because he was talking about the divine smite of the paladin and saying that now a paladin can punch smite and ranged smite. But we just want to see what people think of those as ideas. And he's like, we predict that where it will probably land is that we will take away the ranged smite but keep the punch smite, because that seems like it keeps the paladin kind of in their lane the best. But I just thought it was interesting that they were sort of predicting what they think is right, but they're like, let's see what the public think. Let's see what the audience think of this thing if we just try it in this general playtest.
And I think that's wise, because if you design a game by committee, you're probably not going to get a very good game. But if you also never listen to the people who are playing your game, you're also probably not going to make a very good game. So they have to strike a very delicate balance on how they interpret what the public tells them.
I'm going to go on record right now being a bad guy. I know the game won't end up in this place. I know it already, but I just want people to know I'm on team Smite Shouldn't Crit. That's where I stand. You're already getting to choose. Like, the difference between something like sneak attack, right? Where it's like, oh, you happened to crit on this sneak attack? Wow, roll all them dice twice. Versus Smite, where you get to choose.
I agree. Yeah, sure. I agree.
Yeah, join team bad guy.
And I love, I'm a paladin main through and through. I love my big smite hits, but either make it so you can waste a smite, you know, by having you declare it before you know whether you hit or not, or get the big crits when you roll a 20.
That's my thing.
One way or another.
One or the other.
And to be perfectly honest, as much as I hate wasting smites, I think from a thematic standpoint, it makes more sense to me, storytelling wise, to empower your blade, then make a hit, rather than I hit and then it explodes on the guy.
Well, that's this weird imbalance, though, that we were talking about earlier around the luck mechanic of, like, it feels bad to, like, fail at something, especially when you pump a resource into it. And I think the reason a lot of spells have that, you know, half damage if save is succeeded is because you're spending a resource, and perhaps a fairly valuable resource, before you commit to it. So the key difference between, like, a smite and a sneak attack is that smite requires that resource. So that feel bad moment would be much worse if you lose that resource compared to a sneak attack, which is always constant, available.
That's
you
true.
Always have
That's
it turned
reasonable.
On.
That's true. That is reasonable. And I know it's reasonable, but I'm still going to say what I'm about to say, even though I'm not sure I completely agree with myself. But I was going to say, paladins feel like they've had spell slots, like, laid on top of a very functional class just to give you another thing to do. Like, sure. It doesn't feel like spell slots are very important to being a paladin, and you need to, like, carefully decide whether you're going to have this spell or this smite. you're mostly going to use those spell slots to smite. Like, that is most of what you're going to do.
There was a game.
Or split the difference and just say, if you have to declare it beforehand, you can't crit on it, but if you do miss, then you actually hit. You don't do any extra damage, but your weapon attack does the damage.
Yeah, so, that would be cool.
You know, you can split the difference in lots of different ways.
I did have a game that I was running. This was years ago now, but they were in like a crypt and the wizard was, or maybe it was the rogue, was like opening a box and a bunch of skeletons jumped out at them. And I was like, ha ha. And the paladin's down the other end of the room. And I'm like, paladin, what are you going to do? You've got at least a turn to get there. And the paladin misty stepped into the middle of the skeletons. And I was like, oh, yeah. They do have spells. Just kind of forget that they can do that.
Oh, yeah, your magic, right.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. A little bit of breaking news here, speaking of things that are being released into the general public, I don't know. Chaosium have just tweeted as of 2 hours ago, as of recording, that they are releasing... in April, what looks like a new PDF at this stage called the Basic Role-Playing Universal Game Engine, which is something that they are releasing. There's very little info about this right now. It didn't even link to a blog article. It's literally just a tweet with the cover of a book by the looks of it. But it seems that they are releasing via the Orc an SRD-style thing that is used for their role-playing games, which are Call of Cthulhu and, is it RuneQuest, the other one?
RuneQuest, yes.
Which is a D100 system, roll as low as you can. So that's interesting. Maybe we'll see a couple more of those.
What did you say the name of it was? The full name? I want to see what the acronym is.
The Basic Role-Playing Universal Game Engine.
You can't make that into an easy acronym.
Brugger. Bruges.
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 In Bruges.
In Bruges. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's spelled different though.
Basic has been around for a while, if I remember right. So this is a second edition, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And releasing it under the Orc is probably the story there, as opposed to it that it exists.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. We'll definitely get some confusion given that Kobold Press is looking to call their engine Core Fantasy.
Yes.
I'll be like, which one am I talking about?
I am enjoying these generic role-playing, make whatever you want named systems. Speaking of systems,
kind of a weak
Darren,
one, Ben.
Well, I didn't want to say weak, like generically named systems. Till the Last Gasp has been announced by Darrington Press, and more than just announced, I think you can go purchase it right now. Like, this is not a Kickstarter. This is not a pre-order situation. This is go get it. Becca Scott's already done a video. It's out
Beyonce
there.
Beyonce style. There's the game. Yeah,
here it is. I think this is interesting. You know, it's a product release, and that's not really what I find interesting about this because products are releasing frequently. What I find interesting is that they have tried to merge both a role-playing game and a competitive two-player game into one type of game. And it looks very odd to me because I play a lot of competitive two-player games, like Warhammer Underworlds is what comes to my mind here. And just the way that at the end of the trailer, they have Matt Mercer lose the game and then high-five Marisha Ray, like, oh, I lost. But we're all like, you know, we're in this together. We're telling a story together. It just seemed odd to me. It did, not that I'm like furiously angry after I lose a game or anything, but like it feels like this is not a competitive game.
We know the truth, Ben.
This is a role-playing game first and a competitive game definitely second.
We've heard the stories of you playing Wingspan violently.
If I can't flip the table, I don't want to play.
I still have nightmares about the murder birds.
Right. I don't want happiness in my gaming. What's the matter with you people? No, I think this is awesome. I think this is great. I think this might hopefully introduce Critical Role fans who have maybe only seen D&D being played by Critical Role. And if they investigate this, they'll learn that there is a wide variety of games like this already out there. You can find similar sort of role-playing dueling games out there. You could find they run the spectrum of all role-playing to all combat where there is a winner and everywhere in between. So,
and if you try hard enough, you can turn any tabletop game into a role-playing game. I like to force my friends to role-play when we play Gloom. Voices are involved.
Oh, yeah. I do with Pandemic. If we're playing Pandemic and we're not in the same city, you have to pick up the phone. You have to pick up the phone.
Have you done Pandemic Legacy?
No, we started Betrayal at House on the Hill Legacy, which I don't want to give any spoilers for that because that's really fantastic.
Game from that
Incredible
one.
Really first good. Game. Yeah, amazing. I didn't get very far in it though.
If I can talk about For the Last Gasp for a second.
you know, the thing that's on topic.
I just want to say how awesome it is to have a two-player RPG. The number of times I've been hanging out with like one friend or a romantic partner and been like, I want to play an RPG with you. I'd love to play an RPG with you. And it's like, yeah, cool. But all RPGs are for 3 to 5 players minimum, unless you want to get really avant-garde with it. And it's like, well, never mind, I guess. but this fills a need that, you know, I don't feel like I'm, you know, constantly in need of filling, but every now and then, you know, once or twice a year, this crops up and I'm like, I can't believe no one's thought of this before in a major capacity. So this is great. It seems like a really fun concept, well tied to its actual gameplay, right? Storytelling in a duel. My favorite part of The Princess Bride, basically.
Yeah, I agree. I love the apparent kind of pick up and play. It seems to take, I don't know, 30 minutes, I would assume, or maybe 45 minutes based on what I've seen from the gameplay to play. And exactly like you've said, like some nights I'm like, man, I'm just itching for a game of like Vampire Masquerade, or I'd love to do a quick one shot of Call of Cthulhu. But there's so much process to go through to get a role-playing game happening in terms of character creation or finding pre-gens if you don't have them on hand, and then becoming familiar with those pre-gens, having an adventure to run, having a GM there, you know, willing to run the adventure. The pick-up and playability of this, I think, looks really exciting. Speaking of exciting things, Graham has sent us an email.
Graham.
Potentially
the cracker
Graham
himself
reemerges.
Graham or Graham?
Graham.
Does he have teddies?
Well, are I'm not tiny? Sure.
I'm sure Graham doesn't appreciate these jokes at his expense. He probably gets these every day.
Sorry, Graham.
We're just sorry, Graham. That was in poor taste.
Graham is asking, it was a very quick, very simple email asking how to create setbacks or, quote, humble the party without just murdering them all and dropping them to zero. And I thought this was interesting in relation to our conversation from earlier this episode in terms of having failure as a feature of 5e or role-playing games in general, I suppose. That isn't all feel bad. That still feels engaging, if not, you know, terribly fun in the moment that it happens. How as a GM can you, I suppose, create stakes even that aren't just, if you fail this, you all die?
Well, to embrace the villain arc, the thing that immediately comes to mind is a story that Brennan Lee Mulligan told, where he was saying he had a party of players who, you know, were just kind of yucking it up, having a good time, not caring about the plot hooks for major baddie factions or anything like that, picking and choosing based on money, you know, all the classic player things, right? Like, we do what we want. We don't care about nothing. But they had sort of a hedge witch NPC in the base town that they quite liked and were attached to. And so they went off on one of their money-making quests and came back, and the major baddie bandit faction had murdered her. And suddenly they were invested in the plot. I think that is one way to humble your players. But maybe you're not looking to be the villain as GM. Does anyone have tips for
Bill, you may be the bad guy. I'm about to be the badder guy. And I hope Sean is the baddest guy after me. But
I'm the level 5 big bad. You're level 10.
Take their magic items. Really make them hurt. Your players will hate you if you do this. But if you take their magic items and then don't make them feel like it's impossible to get them back, feel like their next their immediate next goal is get my goddamn plus two flame tongue longsword back, then instantly you have plot hook. And you've created a consequence for failure that is not, you know, death. It's the villain walking over your paralyzed three hit point body being like, you have a lovely sword. I think I will add it to my collection and take it off and then vanish from you.
Also very reminiscent of in my era's series of Ninja Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, there's this bit where they go up against Shredder, but it's too early. They're not strong enough. And Leo's swords get broken. It's very dramatic. Has a whole character arc for him.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'm going to go straight to the baddest.
Yes.
I love this.
So, I mean, Dale's idea is great. If the characters care about something, that you can do that. James' idea is great if they care about their magic items and if they're like that. What if they don't care about anything? What if they're just... That's when you step outside of the DM's screen and you say, are you guys honestly having fun? How do you want to play? Do you want me to continue DMing for you?
You guys are making me sad.
I am not having fun right now for XYZ reasons. So let's see what we can do so we can all have fun. And it may involve you actually having to pay attention a little bit more. But let's all have fun as a team. So that's the baddest. If you step outside of the DM and you become a person again and you actually have to talk to people, communication's good, right? We have X cards. We have these things.
There's a meme for this.
Right.
There's a meme.
we should feel comfortable enough having those difficult discussions if it is to the point that you've gotten to. If it's just, they think they can't be beat, you have tons of DM tricks at your disposal to beat them, right? The monster, it hit. You didn't roll the die. Yes, I know. guess what? You're at zero hit points. It's you could do those sorts of things. It's not fun necessarily or fair, but figure out what the problem is and then address the problem directly if you feel strongly enough about it.
Amazing.
Incredible.
I've got chills.
And if that fails, just call the police, you know, on your players.
The pool noodle.
With the batterist answer.
I have been at conventions where that has happened. So we could, I haven't had to, but yeah, you know, police have been called. People have been taken away. So I'm speaking from a wider range of experience than just, you know, just like a home group or something.
Just adding another branch to this sort of conversation, because I like when I read the word humble, I don't think I necessarily read that as like the players need to be humbled. But just adding in loss conditions to your game that aren't necessarily just killing the party. The party dies.
Is creating, Ben is going to be the nicest.
Creating morally complex situations where the villains aren't always necessarily entirely villainous, or they have some motivation for doing what they're doing. We recently talked in a video that we did like 2 weeks ago about bandits and creating a bandit group of people that attack caravans because they need supplies to survive in the forest. You know, they have illness or they have monsters that they're trying to fight. And so you put your players in a situation where, you could go in there and slaughter all the bandits. Once you learn their story, that might kind of feel bad, but it's still a form of victory. Or, look, we need to, let's bring them to justice some other way or help them, but they still murdered a bunch of innocent caravan guards, so that also feels bad. It's like imperfect solutions. It creates a situation where the party don't feel like they're winning every single encounter, but they're making choices that change the story in a way that's not just victory after victory after victory, if that makes sense. Muddy up the morality of your world, and that might make it feel like, you know, they won, but everybody kind of lost. And that's my dark fantasy advice, I suppose. Yeah.
Giving goals or having them take on goals and then putting alternative obstacles in front of them rather than just, you know, straight up murdering monsters can help players step back and take a look at the larger picture, which sometimes will not necessarily be humbling, but at least be, it promotes awareness, I guess, of the whole game, not just the dice or not just the snacks or not just the the XP at the end of the battle.
Yeah, and forcing them to make a choice doesn't even have to be a moral dilemma, right? It doesn't have to be your trolley problem. It can be like, hey, you want to fight both these bad guys, but you like they're both doing this at the same time. You got to pick one, right? Like it can be about money. It can be about quests. It can be about fun combat. Yeah. Again, I don't know whether it humbles necessarily. That word has such nuance, but.
The princess is in another castle. Could be another way to do this, or you know, similar to what Dale said, the villain reacts. They can't go after the party for whatever reason. The party have killed one of their lieutenants, or the party have stolen one of the villain's magic items. The villain knows they can't defeat the party directly, so they go and like burn down another village or something like they react in some way to lash out at the party that might not be direct, but still feels like, you know, there is a setback.
That's the classic Lex Luthor trick. Yeah, can't go up against Superman, but you can hit him in the heart.
Yeah, right? Until you build yourself a robot armor suit, and then it's time, Superman.
But if I have infinite kryptonite, then...
Well, speaking of infinite kryptonite, the infinite kryptonite of this podcast is time, which has once again defeated us and humbled us, I suppose, as we have once again reached the end of this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. If you have enjoyed this episode and you're watching us on YouTube or listening to us through Spotify or some other platform, feel free to give us star ratings, thumbs up, subscribe to the channel. All those good things help spread the word of the Eldritch Lorecast and get us out to more people, which is we're very appreciative of. Thank you. Sorry, I lost their name, but somebody subscribed on Twitch before, so thank you very much for that. I've been Ben Byrne, here with Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, James Hake, and we will be back next week for another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, and we will see you all then. But thank you to, I'll see if I can quickly find their Twitter handle, the person who made fan art for the Lorecast.
Oh, that was so good.
That was good.
Nick came running down from upstairs in the office. He's like, you have fan art. You have fan art. I'm like, what? Randall Hampton at Randall_Hampton. Double L, Randall_Hampton. Yeah. Thank you. All right, take us offline.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye.